So yesterday we finished looking at some part of NMR, how we do two qubit gates, and how we do the initial states. And then we kind of stopped for NMR there. I'll try to get back to you. So you've read a paper yesterday at the tutorial. Aggie mentioned to me that it would have been good if you would have seen it before so that you get a little bit prepared. Well, next year we'll do this. I'll try to give you another piece when we do quantum error correction, an NMR implementation, so you can again see it in practice of how it works. And this time I'll try to do it this weekend, send it to Aggie so you can look at it. It might not be part of the tutorial, but at least you see the implementation. And then we talk about two other implementations, superconducting qubits and ion trap, very superficially, gave you a few slides just to give you an idea of what's happening in experiments. Any questions? Nope. So we're going to switch gear a little bit. And today we're going to talk about complexity theory, which is very much a computer science subject and not always kind of seen as physics. But quantum information science brings different areas of science and different disciplines together. And today we'll talk about very much more on kind of computer science. And the reason why I want to do this is that quantum information science has had quite an impact in computer science. When you are a computer scientist, you go and do your undergrad, and pretty much the first year, they bang some things in your head, and one of them is the Turing principle, and we'll get to this in a few minutes. And so it's a little bit like when you're a physicist, you learn about Newton's laws straight in the first year, of course, and then you make do a lot of problems, and suddenly you learn that Newton's laws doesn't work everywhere, and then it has to be replaced by quantum mechanics. Quantum computing is a machine that doesn't really fit in the framework of computer science. And this is really kind of shaking the foundation of what is information, how do we manipulate it, what do we do with it, what can we do with it. And so it is really changing that part of computer science. Now, none of you, or maybe some of you are computer scientists and that I don't know about, but most of you are physicists. So I'm going to give you the main ideas today of some of the ideas, give you some example here and there, so you taste it a little bit. But one of the things that I like about quantum information science is that I learn about other science, like computer science. Sometimes I learn about engineering or some chemistry. And people in different fields think differently. They address problem or attack problem in a different way. And this I find it interesting. And I hope you do also. So some piece I'll even at some place say, I'm not sure exactly why they call this thing. We'll talk about a language. I don't know why they use this word in computer science, but you'll see what is this. As long as we define it, then you just say, this is the division related to this. So at the core of computational computing, complexity, which is what we're going to talk about today, there's something called the Church-Turing thesis. So we'll talk about this a little bit. We'll talk about efficiency of algorithms. We'll mention the strong Church-Turing thesis, and then computational complexity classes. And then a little bit of black box at the end, if we do have time. So do you guys know what a Church-Turing machine is? Well, then I should briefly explain what it is. So Turing, 1930s, was thinking about problems of what can we compute and what things that we cannot compute. And then he created this machine that would be like a blueprint or something that kind of with which he can build his theory about what kind of things can be computed or not. So the idea is you have a machine, okay, and a tape, which would be infinite, okay, and then you have a set of state that you can put on each of these part of this tape. So I divide the tapes in a little block, and in a little block I'm going to put a state, and so you have an alphabet that can give you which states you are. For simplicity here, we'll assume that we use binary, so you put some zeros and one in here, okay? And then you have a device that can read this, okay? And when it can read this, then it has an instruction. So there's a list of instructions here who kind of take into account, so that head that reads takes into account the whole state of the system, in particular the one that read, and has an instruction of how to change it. Okay? So it says now we have 1000111. I'm looking at this particular state of the system, and I'm gonna flip it to zero or not. So in some sense, you can think about a control gate in some way that can happen in this. And this is the idea of a Church-Turing machine. And it turns out that if you look at this in 2016, you think that looks pretty much like a computer that we have today, right? You have a machine, you have some memory, and then depending on what is the state of memory where you start, you have a program, then the program gives indication to your computer to change the state of the memory and keeps on going. And at the end, if you have an interesting program, it gives you an answer which is interesting. So it's really a blueprint for what we think about a computer today, but it's well-defined and it's incredibly simple. So it's not incredibly complicated. So you have one tape, you have a set of alphabet, and a program, and something that does changes on the memory one at a time. So a bit different than if you have a machine which would do something which would have would be analog, having a continuous set of state. Here we have a discrete set of state. Okay. And the Church-Turing hypothesis. And by the way, Turing is Alan Turing, and you might have seen there was a movie. That's it. So that's this guy, Alan Turing. So he was a British mathematician, was interested in logic, and in the 1930s, he finished his PhD in Cambridge, cannot remember which college. He went to work with Church, who was in Princeton, and then that's how he started to do this work. And at the end of the 30s, when the Second World War started, he came back to Britain, and he helped the Allies, and the Brits in particular, to decode the encrypted messages that were sent between the Germans. So, and what he did when he was there at a place called Bletchley Park, which is just a little bit, is to turn this theory into practice. So he really built, him and his group at Bletchley Park, really built computers, very on the primitives of the computers, in order to solve a particular problem, which is decrypt information. And interestingly, today I'll talk about complexity theory. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about Shor's algorithm, which is how to factor numbers which are product of prime, which is related also to cryptography. So there's a funny thing here that you'll see. Cryptography is going to come, and then later on is going to disappear again. So the Church-Turing hypothesis is that any physically reasonable model of computation can compute the same functions as a Turing machine. Okay, so this tells to the computer scientist that if you want to compute something and you have an idea of how you compute it, today we use our computers. But if you go back in the time when I was at high school with something called a slide rule, and you can ask the question, can you compute the same thing in a slide rule that you can compute it on a computer? So there you probably said yes, or kind of the slide rule is a little bit more limited. But then you can start to be very imaginative, maybe with some billiard balls. By doing something kind of really clever, you might be able to compute using this. In fact, it is computing something. It's computing Newton's laws and kind of going in a certain direction. Then you can leave people to kind of imagination. Can you start to have a physical machine which would compute things which would be very different than what this machine would compute? And the thesis is, the answer is no. That all physical risk, and it essentially tells also the engineers who are interested to build a computer that they won't be able to do something which is totally different. So you might wonder, and sometimes people say, oh, but what about quantum computers? Aren't they different? And the answer is no. Everything you can compute with a quantum computer, in principle, you can compute with a classical computer. Right?
Yeah, it just takes longer.
That's it. It takes longer. So if I give you any state,
rho,
and I say I'm going to do a unitary transformation, so if I have n qubits, this is 2 to the n by 2 to the n, and same for this. So I'm going to multiply a lot of matrix. It'll be taking a lot of time, but in principle, you can do this. So a quantum computer doesn't violate the Church-Turing hypothesis. It's just a different mechanical system. Okay. But the place where it's going to make a difference is when we start to talk about efficiency. And I think the first people who started to think about efficiency were people who had just built computers and Von Neumann. Von Neumann, the one who worked on the foundations of quantum mechanics, in the 30s, 40s, and the 50s, he was incredibly interested about computers and helped the Manhattan Project. And part of his work in there was to build computers to solve the equations that were related to the Manhattan Project. And he was thinking and asked question, well, what can, in practice, we can compute? This tells us we can compute anything, in principle, if you have an infinite amount of time. But in practice, you're limited. So he started to ask, what is there classes of problems that we know that we can solve? And are there classes of problems that we not might not be able to solve?
Actually, I mean, is it true that every problem is computable?
No. And I think there's something called the halting problem, which is a non-computable. But anything that can be computed by this, so this is slightly different question that you ask. Okay, so there might be problem that where you cannot give an answer, and but that machine that we call a Turing machine is not going to be able to give you an answer. Something crossed my mind when you said something, and now I've already forgotten about it. Okay, so a notion of efficiency. So we want to know how much resources we're going to use to solve certain problems, and what are the resources that we have. So that, think like a physicist. You want to solve a problem. What do you need? Try something.
Bits.
Okay, we need bits. And you've done enough quantum things. So I'm going to, at some point, we'll add qubits if you want. What else?
Unitary operations in general.
OK, so we need operations. Now go back to what we were thinking about when we thought about universal sets of gates. If I give you a generic U, you don't know how to implement this. So
yeah, you can get how close, like as close as you want.
Okay, how do you get as close as you want? I'm trying to pull something out of you.
You need a universal set of
gates. That's it. We have a universal set of gates. Okay, what else? I'm going to say energy. Like you might decide to have a computation which takes an infinite amount of energy in a fraction of a second, right? Would you buy that computer? Why?
Something destructive.
You're right?
Be very destructive.
Yeah, but I would turn it around. If somebody would say to me that their computer can use an infinite amount of energy, I would not believe it. Okay, now if I believe it and indeed has an infinite amount of energy, then you might do a lot of things with it. You could say time also, but time might be related to number of gates. Okay, except if you can do all an infinite number of gates in parallel, maybe it doesn't take time. So these are resources that people are kind of thinking about. And in fact, we should think about all resources, right? Because you don't want somebody to cheat. If somebody says, oh yeah, you just need a few bits, okay? But it's hiding the fact that you need an infinite number or an incredibly large number of resources, then it would not be efficient. So, but in general, you assume that you have finite energy. We'll assume this, that you have finite amount of time. You give the number of gates, okay? So we'll say an algorithm is efficient if it uses a number of gates polynomial and the size of the input. Okay, and we're going to denote this polynomial as poly n, where n is the number of, where n is the size of the input. Okay, and by this, a little bit more detail is that you want to say that if you have a certain number of gates, is at most polynomial in n, okay? So that is, there exists a n0, a c, and a d, so that the number of gates is smaller or equal to c times n to d. And we'll say for n greater than n0. So as you increase the size of your algorithm, sometime it's not very useful. It doesn't look polynomial at the beginning, but suddenly after a certain number of n, it does become a polynomial. So this is what we mean by efficient. Notice that we put in here the size of the problem. So we're not interested to know, to answer right now the question, is it efficient to factor 5,037? We want to know how the number of resources changes as we increase the size of the number we want to factor. So we want to look at trends, okay? And we use polynomial here. And the reason we use polynomial is that it's quite generic. So what we don't want is that suddenly somebody has something which is just twice as fast, and you would say this is a different class. What we want to distinguish is things which are polynomial to things which are not, or exponential. And these changes are quite robust, okay? For example, if you have a Mac or a Windows system, you don't want to say one problem is efficient on the Mac or efficient on the Windows systems. As long as you have a polynomial relation between the two, then that's okay, these are two different classes, okay? Right? Okay. So So this strong church Turing thesis is that computation can be done efficiently in any physically reasonable model, if and only if it can be done efficiently in a Turing machine. Okay? So now the strong Turing principle is a bit different than this one, then we think about efficiency. And there, quantum mechanics, quantum computer, invalidate this. I should be a little bit more careful, we think. Right? And I put the we think because we don't have a proof that you cannot simulate quantum system efficiently. We just don't have one. We have a series of algorithms which are more efficient than their classical counterpart. So we have confidence that quantum computers are more powerful. Now, by the way, this is a little bit embarrassing. We run the Institute for Quantum Computing. We have lots of students and faculty, and we receive funding from the government, and we're not totally sure that quantum computers are more powerful than classical computers. So I'm always worried that one of these funders or stakeholders of IQC are going to ask me that question. And I'm recorded right now, so you should be very careful. But we don't really know. And we don't have a proof on one thing. In fact, for communication, we know that quantum communication is more powerful, but not for computation. But we do have algorithms. We do have place where, in practice, we see a difference. And we'll come back. In fact, some element R shows this. OK, so now what we're going to do is talk about this efficiency and turn this into some classes of problems. And we're going to say, this class of problem can do this, and compare them. In fact, I'm going to show some classes and say this one is included in that one and that one. And this is just what the computer scientists think. There's very little proof of how these things relate to each other. So me as a physicist, I say, what? You get courses on computational complexity if you're not sure of any of these diagrams that I'll show in a few minutes. And they said, no, but this is how we kind of make progress on this. And if we can show that this is not in there, then you gain. So you'll see in a few minutes what this entails. In order to do this, we have to define what is called a language. Now, this is the computer science version of what a language is, which is not similar to the language that you're using here. And you'll see it's a subset of strings of zeros and ones. So the old star there is strings of zeros and ones. And I'll give you some example. Subset of zeros, the set of all bit string of any length and it consists of the yes answers to some problem. So instead of thinking about the numerical answer of something, they're going to ask a question where you just answer yes or no. And I think they do this to simplify things. So just to have the essence of this problem instead of getting kind of in murky details of exactly is this number greater or smaller than something like that. So, and I'm going to give you examples. So that's the thing about one language. The balance function. So is the function balance? And this would consist of a set of strings. So let's put them in binaries. I want to have balance string. Balance means the same numbers of zeros and ones. So give me the smallest one that you would think of. Is 0, 0 balance? No. Give me one which is balance. Okay, give me another one. Another one. Yeah, and louder so I can hear from here. So
0011.
0011. And then you have 1100. 1001. So you can, so we call this a language. And so if I give you some strings, you can verify if it is balanced or not. And this is not too hard to find. Primes is a number prime. So give me in binary what the primes looks like. Okay, what is the first, what?
1, 0.
Okay, 1, 0, which is equivalent to 2. Another one. 1, 1, another one. 5. Okay, you have that. So now you're a language specialist. I'm going to give you one more problem, which, so this one looks a little bit abstract. I'm going to give you another language, which is graphs, and ask them if they are what is called three-colorable. So a graph is three-colorable if it is possible to assign each vertex V of one of three color, C of V. So we're going to call them, okay, I've done too much computer, I'll call them RGB, red, green, and blue. So that any two vertices joined by an edge have different color. Okay, so let's look at one of these languages is the graph with four vertices. Okay, now let's enumerate how many edge can we have with four vertices? Six. So edge number one, which is V1, V2, edge number two, which is V1, V3, 3 is V1, V4, edge 4 is V2, V3, edge 5 is V2, V4, edge 6 is V3, V4. So I enumerate all the edge there. And the language in here is in this graph, a string which corresponds if this, any of these are there. So I'll call it 1, okay, if it's in there, and 0 if it's not there. So I'm going to give you a string, E1, E2, E3, E4, E5, E6. And if it's in there, then it's in there. So if I give you the graph, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, means that there is an edge there. E2 is V1, V3, so it's not there. E3, V1, V4, V2, V3, V2, V4, V3, V4. So this is the graph that we have. Okay? And then the question, the yes-no question for the language is this colorable? Can I put R, G, and B, so that there's no colors. There's a no answer there. Any other? No, you can see it's hard. Right now, learning this, not having talked to any graph theorists, you just try by trial and error. So you could have red. So I cannot have red here or here. So I'm going to put blue here. If red is blue here, I cannot have red and blue here, so I have to have green. If I have green here and blue here, I cannot have blue or green here, so I have red. So it is three-color rule, that one. Okay? And so I knew the answer, so that was easy for me to make that guess. But you can understand how you solve this. Now, let's increase the number of vertices and change the strings. Okay? Which vertices on there? And the yes-no answer is, can you find this? And your task is to find, is this efficient? Is there a polynomial? Well, I have my definition of polynomial. Is this polynomial, or is it not? Anybody wants to make a guess? Now here's an example of a problem which is hard to find. At least right now you don't have any tricks. So the only thing you're going to do is trial and errors. But if I've given you the answer, then all of you look at it and says, ah, that's easy. Okay? So there's a class of problem like this, and we'll get back to this in a few minutes. Okay. A complexity class, okay, is a set of language set of problems, and we can define natural classes depending on some of their properties. I'm going to give you one, P. P is a set of language L that can be decided. In poly time. Or polynomial number of gates, if you have an algorithm. So an amount of resources which are polynomial in poly time. Okay, on input x. Okay, so the algorithm is really poly on the length of x. So if this is yes, then we have that x, a given string, belongs to the language, and it rejects, so it accepts if it is this, or it knows how to reject it if it is not. Now let's think about, do you know any problem that is, before going to ask you this, I'm going to say, and this is a physicist in front of you talking today, when I listen to these easy problems, polynomial and hard problem, I really think about these are the easy problem in our life, and those are the hard problem, the exponential one are the hard problem. Okay? So, do you know any problems which are in the class P? The simplest suggests something. I might not know the answer, by the way.
Adding two numbers?
That's it. Adding no numbers. So what is the length that we're talking about? What is the size of the input when you add numbers?
So the number of bits necessary to describe it.
That's it. And let's not use decimal, let's use binary. So it'll be the length of the string. When we add numbers, okay, so I give you a string. 111001. You want to add it to another number, 100111. How much work do I have to do? Okay, the length. Right now, I've used two strings which are the same, so usually you should take the longest one. I add this and this. That's one step. This and the second step. I might have a carryover, so maybe I have a third thing. But it will typically be the length of the string. Right? The number of steps that I do. So now you've learned that you've, for all that time that you've been adding number, now today you've learned that you've done something which was easy. So, do you know any problems which are hard?
Factorizing?
That's it. Factoring numbers which are product of prime. In fact, we don't know if it's really hard or not. We just don't have an algorithm. Okay? So, here's another class, which is called BPP. Okay? Which is words for bounded error probabilistic. Okay, and this is a set of language. Okay, that can be decided. In poly time. By a randomize algorithm. Okay, X belong to the language, which probability we put 2/3. I never understood why the computer scientists take 2/3 instead of 3/5. I think it's because it's more than 1/2. And the next fraction that comes in is 2/3. If it's 1/2, you have a chance. If you do the same thing again and again, it probably is reasonable to get the right answer. So, and X is not. So we have an algorithm with same thing, probably greater than 2/3. Okay. So the difference between this and this is here we're really using deterministic algorithms. Okay, which is what most of the time you're using in your computer. When you add numbers, it's all deterministic. But sometimes you want to do some computation with a random number generator. So if any of you have done Monte Carlo simulation, you do something, okay, you don't want to know the whole probability distribution, you want to have an estimate of it. And then you use a random number generator. And then you can get a good estimate, which is not as hard as doing the thing totally deterministically. So, this is another class. And so we have P, and then we think that BPP kind of is a little bit bigger. In principle, all the problems which are solvable in this will also be solved in there. Okay? Now there's another class, BQP, so which is the same as this, but instead that having an algorithm, okay, except you can use a quantum computer. Okay? So not only here you had classical probabilities that you can add in the mix, here you have quantum amplitude that you can use in your quantum computation. And what you get is, we believe, or we hope, yeah, maybe we hope that this is bigger than this and this, right? Again, if there's a person incredibly smart, maybe one of you find an efficient algorithm for quantum computation, then this would reduce to this. In fact, the computer scientists think that BPP is equal to P. Okay, that's the conventional rhythm, that these two things are the same. Okay, and I think the people in quantum information science believe that these two are not equal to each other. But interestingly, there are some computer scientists who don't believe in quantum computation, and they think that these two things are pretty much the same. Okay, and when we go to Shor's algorithm, I'll give you an example of why some people are skeptical. Well, first, we've never explored a large part of the Hilbert space. And they think that quantum mechanics might fail. And then you have quantum computation. Okay? There is some other so here we assume that we have a bounded amount of space, a bounded amount of time, because these things are polynomial. But we can make some more general classes. There's my sheet. OK. We can have something called p-space class, OK, which use poly amount of space or memory, but unrestricted time. Okay? And if we go in this picture here, then we think that this is this class. And there's another class, which is called exponential class. And this use exponential time. And we don't care about the amount of space. So this is even bigger. And so this is. We believe that these things are in this hierarchy. But there are people who say, if we look at these two types of problem, then if they are equivalent, then these things could collapse and get to, let's say, the biggest horror for the computer scientists is that everything collapsed to this. And then the quantum information scientists would also be horrified, because then we use classical computers to do everything. Now, on specific instance, maybe the classical quantum computer might be a little bit useful if it's all collapsed. But right now, we believe that this is really a different type of computation. And looking at these hierarchy, then you start to understand why the computer scientists are pretty amazed at quantum computation, because it's a class of complexity, which is something that they had not encountered before the 1980s and 90s. Okay? Finally, there's another class. It is called NP. And the first time that physicists look at this, they say, oh, it's non-polynomial. And this, unfortunately, it's non-deterministic polynomial. And this class is a funny one. It is a class of problems that can be solved, that if you get the answer, you can verify easily. So it doesn't say how hard it is to solve this problem, but it tells you that if I give you the answer, it's easy to verify. Okay? And we think that that class NP is of form. So definitely, the polynomial problems are part of that class, because if you add this, it's easy to verify. But there are problems that are believed to be outside the P class. And it turns out the problem I gave you, the three-color ball, is believed to be an NP problem. OK? So it is an NP, and we believe that it's outside P. Factoring is an example of where we think it's outside. But we are not totally sure if factoring is NP or not. Yeah. Now, computer scientists likes to be formal, so I'm going to define it. So if x belongs to L, there exists a y, which is a solution. And an algorithm x and y, which accepts this x. And this is called the completeness. And there is something called the soundness, that if x is not equal to L, does not belong to the language, there for all y, there is an algorithm AXY which rejects X. Okay. As part of this problem, there's a subset which is called NP-complete. So it's a family of problems. And this family of problem is such that if you can solve one of these problems, you can solve all the other NP problems. So it's like a grandparent of those. So if you get that one, you get all the children which are part of that family. Okay? And it turns out that three correlable graph is one of those. So if one day you are get distracted, you are solving one of those, you hit the jackpot. Yeah, you solve any of those in one shot. Okay. Let me get my notes. Questions? So the last thing I want to mention, and this is something that we will use all of it. When we think about... Thank you. Which is called black box computation. So when we look at the complexity of solving certain algorithm, we assume we have gates do certain things and build up things. Physicists always want to build everything from scratch, so they usually they don't think about these black box. But sometimes there are problems where you can get query something, and the black box is going to tell you something about it. So an example of this is, suppose you have a function which is zero everywhere, except to one place. So you have 1, 2, 3, and so you have a function x is equal to 0 if x is not equal to x0 or 1 when x is equal to x0. So if you try to make an algorithm with this, you'll have to build that function in there, takes a lot of things. So computer scientists like to think, oh, maybe we have a circuit. Just tell me which x you want to put. I'm going to give you an output, f of x. And then you'll look at the complexity of this, not by looking at all the wires that goes through this to make this function work, but just how many times you query that black box. Yeah? And when we go and look at Grover's algorithm, we'll assume this, which is turns out to be exactly that question of you have a function which is zero everywhere, and except for one, you find and you want to find this. Okay. Now, if this is a large number, then it turns out that if you would have to put all these zeros in there, would take if you would have to build this function in the memory of the computer, that would take a lot of time. Here. So people go and look at class of problems, finding the non-zero part of a function. It is an unstructured search. And then you go and look at this, and we'll come back to this when we do. Okay, so that's where I want to stop with complexity theory. So my goal today was not for you to become specialists of complexity theory from computer science, but having a little bit of the ideas of why this is important in quantum information science. Because quantum computers are believed to be in a class which is very different than what people have done. So it's a very different type of machine than what computer scientists have been dealing with up to now. So that part is important. And they give you a little bit of the background of the language of why how this complexity theory, all these theories are put together, some of the problems that quantum computers are able to attack. I should add one of them, one comment. It's quite often referred to, if you look at the general public press, that quantum computer can solve exponentially hard problem, or NP. And if you look at this circle here, okay, this is quantum computers, and this is there. We don't really believe that quantum computers can solve NP problems. Okay? So there's a class of problems which don't belong to NP that quantum computers might be able to solve. But there are problems in NP that the quantum computers, we don't think that they can solve. So here's one example where we don't believe that quantum computers solve. So these ones with the graph. But here's one which is really practical. We have a set of cities. And then we're asking, what is, we have a travel salesperson who wants to go to all these cities, and you try to find out the shortest path. And this is an NP problem. And this is a really practical problem. You think about airplanes that are going to all these destinations. And so with a finite number, like airplane companies spend a lot of time on computers trying to kind of minimize the amount of places where they send airplanes so that they minimize the amount of fuel that they're using and cost of sending them to places and coming back empty. So you have the distance between these cities. So it's one of these graph looking things, and you say, what is the shortest path? We don't believe that quantum computers really help in some ways. Okay? But it helps somewhere else. And tomorrow we'll talk about Shor's algorithm, which is an algorithm which takes a number which is a product of two primes and try to find the two primes. Okay? Thank you.